tonight, as a bit of a preview to Ron Muick, which opens this weekend, Charlie Clark, Ron Muick's longtime exhibition manager, is in conversation with the Modern Senior Curator, Andrea Carnes, to take a close look at Muick's work, especially the last 10 years, which is the focus of this exhibition, picking up where the Modern's last Muick exhibition ended. I think if any of you remember that show, that may be very well be why you're here tonight and why you're looking forward to this exhibition. It was one of the museum's most popular exhibitions, setting attendance records, and I suspect we'll get that kind of response with this exhibition as well. Andrea and Charlie are here to dive deep into work that is so immediately appealing that its greater contribution can often be missed. So we're glad to have them here. Andrea brings her professional insights, and of course, Charlie is key. With a background as an artist himself, Charlie has the knowledge and sensitivity required to do what he does, and therefore truly know the work of Muick and his practice better than anybody else. We are fortunate to have him here tonight to share his insights and Andrea to direct the conversation. So if you would, please join me in welcoming Andrea Carnes and Charlie.
Terry, thank you so much. And to all of you tonight, thank you for your time and for coming out. We hope it will make it interesting for you.
We'll try.
I want to first say, Charlie, we're here to talk about the work of Ron Muick, but just in a few sentences, how long have you worked with Ron, and what exactly do you do?
What do I do? Okay. Difficult questions first. I've known Ron since the beginning of his time as a sculptor, which is about a 20-year career so far, and I met him right at the very beginning when he was starting out. And I came to have, over that time, I've worked with him sort of on and off, but more on and off because, you know, I work with him when there's something particular to do. And over that time, I've gradually come to work more and more closely on, particularly on exhibitions. He's a lone artist. He tends to spend much of his time alone in the studio and prefers to work in that way. But I started out by, you know, helping with the packing of sculptures and building of plinths and working out how things should be displayed. And then one time it seemed like a good idea to come to the exhibition and help to install them. And then the next time it seemed like a good idea to stick around and, you know, help working on the placement of the sculptures, which seemed to be so crucial, and then to stay and work on the lighting, and then, you know, eventually it seemed like a good idea, maybe I come to the museum first and have a look at it, and then we could have a decide which sculptures to try and borrow from the exhibition. Gradually, over that time, I've kind of, you know, I've started to just cover all aspects of, particularly of exhibitions, which is, I think, actually it's quite a unique place in the art world because museums and galleries, often the art world's very layered. You know, people, they have a curator and the technicians and they're separate, and then somebody talks to the press and somebody does this. And things are very layered, and it's very difficult to move through those layers. But it actually gives you a kind of unique experience to be able to know the work from the studio and from the time that the artist is working on making it, and then to know it all the way through to the end, mm-hmm. you know, to the day when the public come in, and that's I think that really helps. Actually, it helps me, and I think it's
and you Ron know, Muick it, obviously trust you to come in and after 20 years. And,
well, we've done it together. A lot, you know. When I started out, I was in the background watching how he did it and how the curators did it and how they worked things out together. And the more I got involved with it, you know, we ended up traveling together, and the two of us would do it. And we'd be sitting in the corner scratching our heads trying to work out how to make things work. And
it's always good to have somebody to bounce things
Absolutely. You should never do any of those things on your own, because it's very difficult to see for your for yourself.
I think we want to move kind of quickly through a couple of early works that are not in the exhibition, but just sort of, I think most of you know who Ron Muick is and probably saw the exhibition here 10 years ago. But just to kind of remind you and set it up, we thought we would first start with this slide of the piece called Dead Dad that was in the Sensation exhibition that was Charles Saatchi's collection, first opened at the Royal Academy in 1997 and then traveled and was controversial for a number of reasons. But this work by Muick, of course, made a huge splash and was not part of the controversy, but was a very much talked about piece within the exhibition.
Yeah, I think so, because there were some kind of sensational sides to that exhibition. It was in the press a lot, and there were some bad boy artists and some bad girl artists, and there were some sort of exciting and controversial things going on, and it seemed like a really exciting time in the art world, particularly led by Charles Saatchi, collecting and supporting these young artists. But sort of quietly through all that, everybody just remembered Dead Dad. There was nothing controversial about it at all. It was just there on a low plinth in the exhibition. And it was just instantly, remarkable. And everybody remembered it. And it seemed to sort of appear out of nowhere and in a sort of completeness. And that's a sort of characteristic of Ron's work that's traveled through his career, is that these sculptures do somehow arrive in a sort of completeness.
And this one was the first one that really made a name for Ron Muick as an artist, even though he had made some works before this, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yes.
And then
he'd been shown at the Saatchi Gallery, but Dead Dad was when the public first really started
to take notice,
yes.
And then this work, Boy, from the... was in the Venice Biennale in 2001.
It was, yeah.
And do you want to say anything about that?
I guess that was the sort of next time when it was really, really in the public eye, was because this was a sort of sensation in Venice. It's a colossal sculpture. It's over 5 meters tall, which is completely different from the sort of 4 foot Dead Dad that people had known before. Mm-hmm. It was a colossal undertaking to make. It was in this very low pavilion in Venice. Again, was just an instant hit and something that everybody remembered.
You mentioned the scale, and Dead Dad, I think, is 3 feet.
Is it possibly? Yeah. It's about that big.
And so just, what is that scale shift? What does that scale shift do that Muick's work, everyone probably knows, is never life-size? It's always smaller than life or larger than life. And that affects the mood or how we read the piece.
I think it, in some ways, it affects everything about the piece. And it's clearly something which is in every one of his sculptures. It's a factor, but I think it's difficult to say anything about it as an idea about scale or a theme. I don't think shifting scales is a sort of theme. It's just something about the individual sculpture and the way that you perceive it and the way that you approach it. I think, first of all, the scale comes with the sculpture. It comes with the idea. It's not, I'm going to make this, maybe it should be big or maybe it should be small. How would it work best, or where's it going to go, or how will it fit? It sort of comes with it. There are none of his sculptures you could imagine being on a different scale to what it is. It just wouldn't work. It wouldn't be the same thing. I think the role of scale changes in in each work. I mean, you know, maybe when we look at more particular
sure.
we can works, we can come back
the way
to scale works
and
in each
sort
one.
Of compression of space yeah. or not, or expansion of space around a piece. But also I just want to ask quickly about the sources before we move on, because this is called Dead Dad.
Yeah.
I'm assuming it's Muick's
I believe it's his father. Ron doesn't really talk a great deal about the sources for his work, because I think that, because I don't think it matters. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think it matters to the public, to the viewing public, what the source is, because, you know, from somewhere these things have come, and then they're presented to the world, and everything that he feels you need is in it. So that a sort of backstory is not necessary. But they come from a variety of different places. Again, I think it's individual. It might be a moment noticed in the street. It might be something from the imagination. It might be something that was sparked by seeing an image or seeing something or responding to a material, you know, in the relating to the sculpture Poke, which we're going to look at
right.
later, and that long stick.
So they're not, well, I mean, I think what you're saying is they're not autobiographical necessarily. They're just, they're maybe even.
Yeah, I don't think that's important. I mean,
if they
do relate to particular people or particular moments from his own life, then I don't think that's necessarily important.
Mm-hmm.
Although, of course, with Dead Dad, he did call it Dead Dad, so he's
right.
giving us.
Right.
He's giving us something. But I think it sort of stops there, because he's not inviting us to look at his
right.
father. He's inviting us to contemplate what's in front of us. And, you know, that Rolin can relate to us in some particular way that's our own.
So most of you probably recognize this piece from the permanent collection here at the Modern. And it is the most popular piece in our collection, and when it is not available for viewing, we usually hear about it.
Yes.
So we try to have it on view as often as possible. And though this exhibition that opens this week really focuses on Ron Muick's work since 2007, which is when our last exhibition was,
yeah.
We included Seated Woman from our collection from 1999. And again, this is based on a relative, it's inspired by
yes,
someone, but I'm assuming at some point it's divergent from her, or, you know, the choices get changed, or...
Ron says very little about his work, but I do remember him saying about this when somebody asked him, you know, about who it was, and it was sculpted from a particular person, but that... You know, it was more of a study of old womanliness than of that mm-hmm. particular lady.
And maybe
just
the same
for her,
dead
so,
dad, in a way.
Yeah, you know? I think so. You know, I think it so, must be, I would, you know, knowing Ron, I would imagine that's exactly the way she used to sit. You know, there was something very specific about that and the way she held her hands, I'm
mm-hmm.
guessing. But I, there must have been something in that, you know, that... He sort of felt was poignant,
mm-hmm.
And spoke of something more universal than the particular moment, and so the moment is sculpted, and then, you know, where the moment came from is gone, but what it speaks of more universally is, you know, is there to be interpreted by everybody, and I think if it rings true, it rings true because, you know, he was right. There was something in that moment, mm-hmm. the way that old lady sat that day, that, you know, that did speak about that moment in life or about the relationship.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, this piece sort of starts the beginning of what, or for me, it triggers what I think of are some broad themes in his work.
Mm.
And one, I mean, she's touching her own hands here, but one
yeah.
is clasping the hands or touching. Or
yeah.
that idea of connection, either with the self or someone else. And
yeah.
that, you know, sometimes, you know, usually it's either a singular figure like this or it's a couple. And just I wondered if there's anything to that or if you could talk about some of the broad themes.
I think when I look at that sculpture and think about the, you know, the hands are very prominent there, and I think they're a part of it that you can look at and you can really feel, and it's the way he's looked at those hands and he's understood and felt how, you know, they squash each other and how they relate to each other, and whether that's her hands or in the case of another sculpture, it's one figure touching or holding or grasping another. Yeah, there we go with that man is leaning on the woman's leg and he's holding her arm with his hand, and that's, you know, there is a moment of touch there, but I think in the immediacy, what's happening is that flesh is pushing flesh, and that gives a sculptor something to do.
Right.
In exactly the same way that, you know, if you're sitting, the weight of you spreads the flesh and the form, and that, you know, that gives the sculptor something to do.
Well, and that, I mean, we can kind of go back to some of the themes. For me, but I also want to talk about what you just said, which is gravity. Mm. But I read a lot of these as vulnerability. Like that. I don't know if that's a theme of his or not, or if he thinks about it, but...
I can't speak for him. I don't... So in a sense, I don't really know, but my experience of standing in front of that sculpture is that you do feel a sort of fragility. Mm-hmm. You experience, you know, partly because of her age, I think, but partly because of the expression on her face and partly because of her scale. Mm-hmm. Again, you experience a sort of sense of her fragility. But you also feel a whole life somehow. It's not just a study of flesh and the way it you know, the force of gravity acts on it. It's sort of convincing about a whole life, and everything in it seems to be a part of that. Her stockings, her shoes, the necklace, and that earring, the way her hair is, and that, you know, the sort of slightly odd look on her, the way her eyebrows are arched, and you know, as if she's sort of slightly straining to remember something or think of something, or she's slightly worried about something. Mm-hmm. I think that's one thing, you know, that he does manage to do is to convince of a whole person. And, you know, that's one reason why there's so much sort of detail there, nothing which in itself tells us anything more specific than what that detail is, but the whole thing together.
But the works do seem sort of bookended by a narrative that we don't know.
Because it's convincing of a whole person, a whole life.
But this one, I mean, maybe this one speaks to that better. It's convincing of a whole person.
Oh, sure, yeah. Okay, so there's clearly some narrative, isn't there? There's some story. Mm-hmm. It's just that we don't know what it is.
Right, but she's got a story too. But
for sure. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
But right. But I mean, the point of these frozen moments is, I'm thinking, is probably not to be narrative or not to be not to have a specific narrative, but just we all sort of can draw our own conclusions about.
I think it's definitely not to have a specific narrative, and I think there's a lot of things either in the sculpture or left out of the sculpture, mm-hmm. which allow it to sort of remain ambiguous, so that it remains open to different interpretations. You know, you don't have to bring a story to it. You can bring whatever story you like to it, but you know, you don't have to bring a story to it. You can, you know, experience it and enjoy it for the formal qualities of shape and form and the gravity and so on. It's completely ambiguous as to she's looking down at him in some way, and he's looking off into the distance. But we don't really know if they're married or their girlfriend and boyfriend or something. We were doing a little tour of the exhibition in Houston, and somebody there was saying, you know, this man and his wife, and they've been married for some years and so on. And it just occurred to me in that moment, you know, maybe this man doesn't, maybe this man's wife doesn't know he's on the beach with his girlfriend. You know, because we're not told it, anything of that. You know, it's you can make assumptions, but I think you're open to relate to it in whatever way you do. You know, it might really. I mean, her hands remind me of the way my grandmother's hands used to feel when I held them when I was a child, because there's a sort of certain puffiness of this skin and flesh that just rings true to me. But you know, maybe that moment, you know, relates to every individual in a different way. To you might think of your parents, or you might think of your partner, or you might just be thinking about relationships. You know, there's something ambiguous about the way his hand is holding her arm, and that's another thing that often happens with couples in Ron's work is that, you know, that could be protective, or it could be slightly dominating, or it could be slightly overprotective, or it might just be loving it, or you know, that's just the way it is in that moment. I think it's just open to almost any interpretation.
Well, and you mentioned that she's looking down at him and he's looking away, and that kind of gaze is another theme that recurs in the work. But there's something, even though they're together, there's something introspective about both of them.
I think, when there's two figures in a sculpture of Ron's, the relationship is complicated.
Yeah.
Because relationships are, yeah. And you know, he's found a moment when you know, even if it's a loving relationship, it's slightly more complicated than that, because you know, they're two individuals, and here's an interaction between them. And so, you know, somehow that's expressed. These two whole lives are expressed. And scale works again, you know, again in this piece, because it's so large, approximately twice life size.
14 feet, I think, is the total.
Something which may, you know, which feels colossal, actually. There's something very monumental about them. And I think, you know, in this instance, that means that you can approach the sculpture. You can get much closer into their personal space than you would be able to in, you know, in life. You can sort of, you know, you can get up there and look up into her face, and you can be, you know, you can sort of be a part of that. You can just become more intimate with it. You can get closer. I think sometimes if the scale is small, it allows you to get closer to a piece, and it works the same with it being big. It's just, for that particular piece, it just helps you to get closer, and you know, the way you perceive the piece.
Kind of on that idea of how you perceive the piece, and this, I want to get out of, like, you know, sort of interpretation of the piece and more into the formal qualities of the sculpture. But there is a complete sense of gravity with all of Ron Muick's work, but this one is a great example of it, and kind of a downward pull in this case of what is, you know, represents flesh.
Yes.
But in sculpture in general, you know, you have to deal with gravity. I just wonder, there are things about the works that are completely accurate, and then things about the work that are exaggerated to maybe create the psychology of the work or the mood, or I don't know.
I think just to make the whole thing convincing as bodies. I mean, if you know what is accurate, if you you don't see things in that way. I think, you know, it's not necessarily a sort of conscious distortion, but you know, sometimes you have to make a foot slightly bigger in order to give it a sort of feeling of being grounded. Mm-hmm. And if something's very tall, you know, any sculptor will tell you that you get a sort of foreshortening mm-hmm. effect, which mm-hmm. means that, you know, and, you know, every sculptor who's every work from Donatello, or, you know, onwards had to make the, you know, the head bigger so that it, right. it looked in proportion when the thing was big. But I think that, I think what you're touching on is that part of the way that's so convincing about flesh and form is because he's not sort of slavishly recreating reality, you know, in a measured way. Mm-hmm. It's all about when he's sculpting, I think. What he's doing is sculpting the way what it feels like to look at something, mm-hmm. rather than necessarily just what something looks like. If that's a distinction that makes
absolutely.
Sense. So when he's sculpting it, it's less, you know, measuring it to make sure that the, you know, this foot goes into the leg so many times and that mm-hmm. works. It's more to do with, you know, what is it? Does it feel right mm-hmm. when you look at it? Because reality often doesn't look right.
Right.
And, you know, if you take a life cast of a body, it doesn't look the right size, mm-hmm. doesn't it? Sculptors know that as well, that, you know, it looks 5% smaller or mm-hmm. something than real life because there's no movement.
Right.
Well, if you want to sculpt a figure and make it convincing, you can't just have what it is in that moment. Mm-hmm. You've got to sculpt what it feels like and what a figure feels like is, you know, is these small movements that even of somebody that's standing still or sitting still. And that's all got to be sculpted in. And the only way to do that is to look at it and think, what does it feel like to look at something, and then try to recreate that.
So when you say look at it, you mean look at actual body parts of people?
Yeah, what does it feel like to look at your hand?
And
when
on,
yeah, and yeah. You know, when you're looking at the hand on the sculpture, you know, does that what does it feel like to
yeah.
look, not just what is it, you know, what happens here and then what happens there and how big is that compared to, you mm-hmm. know, what does it feel like mm-hmm. to look at it? I think that's something that's more, you perhaps get more in with a painter, you know, where you're not making something that's actually physically mm-hmm. there, you're sort of recreating it flat, you know, and you know, our figurative artists would paint things, but you can't just do a measured thing. They have to mm-hmm. see, you know, is looking at this two-dimensional painting, is that what it feels like mm-hmm. to look at a hand, you know? And Matisse knew that you couldn't just do it at, you know, he could make it feel more like what it feels like to mm-hmm. look at it if you forget about most of it and, you know, make these big shapes and mm-hmm. make that sort of work. And I think, you know, it's perhaps a mistake to think that you start off by slavishly recreating reality mm-hmm. and then distort certain things mm-hmm. in order to make it feel better. Mm-hmm. You know, because I don't think there ever is that relationship between the sculpture and reality. Mm-hmm. I think it's a completely different thing. So you're coming at it from a completely different way. It might look like, you know, the way to start would be to sort of, you know, recreate it as much as you can and then mm-hmm. And then change certain things. But actually, I think you're coming out from a completely different place, mm-hmm. which is always, what does it feel like to look at something? And when I look at this thing that I'm sculpting, does it feel convincing? Does it mm-hmm. feel right? And if it feels right, then it doesn't really matter what it looks like. You know, in the case of Ron's work, it looks pretty much like what mm-hmm. a body looks like. But he doesn't have to go into that, you know, accurate and come out again.
Right.
It's just a question of trying to make everything feel right and convincing in a whole.
There is a I mean, things aren't absolutely yeah. accurate in the work, and they don't need to be, but
no.
there's still an illusion that's not broken mm. or a thing that takes the viewer to not only the place of, like, looking at something convincing, whether mm. it's out of scale or exaggerated here or there or whatever, mm. but also just like creating that sort of empathy or that sort of observation of humankind that we all can identify with because we're human. Well, you know.
Yeah. I think part of what you're talking about is the continuity of detail and you know, I mean, it never occurs to me that Ron is a sort of hyper-realist sculptor in a sense, because it's not an attempt to make an illusion, and it's not an attempt to, you know, although the thing is crammed with details, you know, it's not an attempt to sort of, you know, do it for its own sake. You know, I think if he's sculpting a big toe, he's probably not worried so much about what he's telling us about the big toe. He's more worried about making it consistent with the rest of the sculpture. Because if there was something sort of wrong about it, that's what would draw your eye. So,
right.
Something's got to be, you know, if it's twice life size, for example, you know, there isn't that much detail to put in. You can't fill it because you've made it twice as big. But if you're sculpting something that's half life size, there is too much detail to put in. You know, there's twice as much detail as you have room for.
Right.
So you have to edit, and you know,
I mean, this is a small,
yeah, exactly.
A small
so,
work.
So these, this sculpture is, I don't know, is about this big or something.
Well,
something like that. And they're incredibly detailed. But I think the way that they're convincing is because of the continuity of that detail. You know, you could sort of go into it further and with, you know, magnifying glass or a microscope and but more details. But there's enough there, I think, is what I'm saying. You know, there's enough there to make those two figures convincing. And
well, that's another question I have or thought I have about our exhibition here. Yeah. We have 7 works total.
Yeah.
And I mean, you're saying there's enough there. And so that, you know, to me, 7 works in a Ron Muick exhibition is a pretty large-scale exhibition of works by Ron Muick.
Yeah.
And I don't know if... I mean, each work requires a lot of its own space or kind of an isolation from the other works. But also... There's a magic to each one of these works, and as a viewer, does it help us or to have more information, you know, to have more sculptures to look at,
or to have more sculptures,
or
it doesn't feel like a small exhibition at all, does it?
It
feels like we've got everything we need. I mean, I think the biggest exhibitions we've ever done probably have been 13 sculptures or something like that. And I think that, you know, you're very often putting, you know, we've got 3 sculptures in a room upstairs where you might have 25 paintings and 14 sculptures as well on other occasions.
Sure.
They just do seem to take up a lot of space. Mm-hmm. They can command a lot of space.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of space around them that they take up, if they get too close to other ones, you somehow can't see them. If you walk into a room and you've got 3 sculptures straight in front of you and you don't quite know where to go, somehow it doesn't help to see them. It seems to work better when you can walk into a room, and even though it's not sort of dictated, you walk this way and turn that way and look at that, but you sort of know where you're going, and something catches your eye. It's very nice if at the same time, in your peripheral vision, you know, you can see a foot sticking out from a doorway or something else hanging out down, and you're aware of these other things, but you can't see them. But it does seem to work best if you have a sort of definite approach to an individual sculpture, and you have space and time to appreciate it. and to get involved with it before you sort of bump into another one.
And, you know, just I know from working with you this week and discussing where each work would go, and we made some changes that, you know, it didn't work out exactly as it did on paper, in other words. We moved things around. It never does, and that's the fun part and the interesting part. If it did work out how it worked out on paper, I would be worried about it. But but I guess, you know, those decisions, those nuances about space between works or which way maybe a sculpture faces or how, you know, how it's directed in the room or what the approach is like for the viewer, that's something that you really bring to the table because you have such an understanding of the works.
I think when the sculptures are first made, that you don't know any of that stuff. You don't know how it should be or how you should approach it or quite what it's going to feel like. And obviously each space that each museum or gallery space that you're in, you know, has particular things about the nature of the space, the architecture, the layout, and so on that add something into the mix. But
I'm just moving to an issue.
But I think when you know, particularly when a sculpture is first made, you don't necessarily know how it's going to feel in a space and how much space it's going to take up and in what way you're going to want to observe it. But I think we never get stuck in a rut because it always happens different. In a new space, the sculpture somehow feels different. You know, there's always, I can remember last time we had it, you know, this sculpture this side and we went from this one to this one, and you think maybe that'll work again, but then it usually doesn't for some reason because you're in a different place and different space, and everything, you know, they seem to react differently to different spaces. And you know, the rooms upstairs give us this opportunity to have, you know, there's three rooms but they're connected by this corridor going through that, and that's a great opportunity to see something through the doorway and then have something else to look back at.
And with this piece, Woman with Shopping, that is in the exhibition, we have her, I mean, she's a small scale.
Yeah.
And we have this work placed in a kind of a, we've given a lot of space to this work. And I don't know what it would be like because we didn't try her in a more compressed space, but there is something about each of these works that can, the mood can change of the piece based on the space around.
Yeah, I mean, I thought there's been occasions, you know, when you can put a very small sculpture in a very, very big space all on its own, and that seems to work. And on another occasion, you know, it's in a much smaller space. Upstairs, we've got three rooms, and they're quite open plan. Between them. Other museum spaces have sort of niches and separate spaces, and so, you know, it gives a sculpture a different character completely if it's in a much more compressed space, but at the same time that might still, if it's a niche, that will isolate it from other works, so that gives it its own space, even if its own space is much smaller. Here, it's essentially in a niche, isn't it? It's just a very, very big niche,
it is.
Which is
big.
Actually half a room.
For this size work, it is. Just a couple more views of Woman with Shopping.
Well, that's another thing, isn't it, that we want to give people room to get round the sculptures and to see them. And you know, there's very often something to find from the other side that you don't quite get at first. Like, you know, with this sculpture particularly, you know, you see her head on, you can see that the baby's there, but I think maybe if we go one more slide, we'll see that, you know, there's something rather nice to find when you actually walk around the back of the sculpture. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I mean, it's rather cute, which is nice, isn't it? But, you know, that's partly what the ambiguous relationship is in the sculpture, this baby looking up at the mother, and the mother is looking
straight out. Ahead.
And, you know, I think it's, you know, she's clearly slightly overwhelmed or worried or
Or something.
Or she's just tired. You know. So I don't think there's nothing sinister about that. But it's, you know, it's complicated, like human mm-hmm. relations are. And, you know, life's tough, and here's, you know, here's a little bit of life.
Mm-hmm. So, with this work, Drift, which is also in the exhibition, I feel like this is another good opportunity to talk about Muick's relationship to sculpture, but also to painting, because this work is, it's hanging on the wall.
Yeah.
And even though it is, if you had the opportunity to walk around it, it's three-dimensional. It is hung like a relief, or like a, you know, you can't walk all the way around.
No.
So what, I mean, he's stretching, or he's questioning sculpture here, I feel like. I don't know.
I think...
I mean, this piece could be on the floor.
It could be on the floor. I think it was part of the conception of the piece. I don't want to try and sort of think or remember exactly where each piece came from, because, again, I think that's a personal thing that, you know, everything that we, you know, need to see and feel about the piece is in it. But I do remember that he had this photograph of this man lying mm-hmm. on this beach, Lilo.
He looks like thing. Huey Lewis to me.
and he put it on the wall. It was on the studio wall, this mm-hmm. this photograph. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, for him, that for Ron, that was very much part of the point. It was always going to be on the wall, mm-hmm. I think. It was never going to quite be on the floor. And it would have been a very different thing if it was on the floor. You wouldn't have seen it in the same way, of course. Mm-hmm. But I think that the partly because of the physicality of it, you know, the lying down there with the arms out like mm-hmm. and what the gravity is doing to the arms like that, it comes from this guy being on the water, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Well, you couldn't do that on the gallery floor, because the gallery floor is not like the water. It doesn't, you know, his hands would be in the water if he was there. So, you know, you could paint the floor blue, or you could mm-hmm. put a little pond there and float him in it. But, you know, that would be going too far from, because it's the person that we want to look at.
So was the wall always planned to be blue?
No, I don't think it was. But I think that perhaps when he first put the sculpture on the wall, I think two things happened. First of all, he put the sculpture on the wall, and I'm sort of surmising here because mm-hmm. I don't know exactly. Mm-hmm. But what I imagine happened is that he put the sculpture on the wall, and then it was something odd about it. Mm-hmm. You know, it just didn't look right, didn't quite look as he'd imagined it. And somehow, because the wall wasn't blue, that was weird. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not a particularly watery blue, mm-hmm. and it's certainly not a sort of, you know, well, he hasn't painted a David Hockney swimming pool
right.
kind of effect, or taken a photograph of water mm-hmm. and blown it up and pasted it on the wall. You know, it's not an illusion of water, but somehow it just grounds it.
Yeah.
It just refers enough mm-hmm. back to what you're expecting that it doesn't seem odd. And I don't, you know, I mean, for a sculptor like Ron, who every sculpture is sitting on the floor or is on a white plinth, or, you know, might mm-hmm. be hanging from the ceiling, but, you know, there are no other sculptures he's made that are sort of room installations, you know, mm-hmm. up to this point, that are room installations like that, where you have to paint the wall something, or you have to build a particular box to sit it in, or you have to look at it through, you know, in a particular way. So, I mean, it's quite a departure for him in that sense, but I don't think it feels like that. It just mm-hmm. sort of somehow feels totally natural, and I think that's just because that blue is just enough to make it seem normal. The other thing that happened with that, of course, is that when the sculpture is... I think he knew from the start that, you know, this was going to have a kind of cruciform mm-hmm. quality. It was going to refer, you know, in some way to the crucifix. That would just be noticeable.
Mm-hmm.
But when the sculpture was hung dead straight on the wall,
mm-hmm.
that seemed to sort of take over.
Too referential.
All you thought was, you know, we've taken him off the water and nailed him to the wall.
Right.
And, you know, to make a crucifix
right.
out of it. And that just sort of took over. But as you turn him round, if you twist him round to sort of...
off-kilter,
you know,
a little.
10 degrees or something.
Yeah.
It actually had this amazing visual effect. As you just stood there and you looked like you were standing there looking down on it.
Mm-hmm.
You had a kind of vertigo feeling. It was quite uncanny that you just looked like you were in the air looking down on it. And so what he's done actually is to move it back to sort of 4.5 degrees or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And actually you get both. And if you get the opportunity to stand in that room... you know, without
which
any
you
other
will.
People in, it, hopefully without, you know, without any other people in your peripheral vision,
yeah.
you can actually, it is a little bit of a sort of optical illusion. You can actually feel both things. You can feel that you're standing there and there's a blue wall and the sculpture's on
mm-hmm.
it. You can also feel like, you know, the whole room has just tipped up.
And you're looking down.
And you're looking down on him. And it just gives it this slight bit of movement, and it just looks a little bit like it's kind of drifting. And you'll notice as well that we just hung it very slightly off centre
mm-hmm.
on the wall, which actually made a tremendous difference.
Absolutely.
Because the room, a bit like this room here, I think it's in the middle in that room, that there was just something about the symmetry of the room. There's a lot of symmetry in this building anyway. You know, you notice that the lines of the floorboards match up beautifully with the tiles on the wall or something. And the panels in the ceiling and the lighting tracks and everything, it just sort of pointed to the middle. And that it just lost that quality of movement slightly. And as movement, we moved him 18 inches to the right or something.
Mm-hmm.
It just put that back in. I think in that way, you get this kind of... As you walk down the room towards it, you get this, you know, the sculpture gets bigger, but also the wall gets wider,
mm-hmm.
and it's a sort of zoom in, track out thing, and that the whole wall is a kind of, you know, it looks a bit like a film, you know, movie format, doesn't it? I think that's a kind of, cinematography, feeling in that. Yeah, and I wouldn't say it's a sort of reference or anything that's, you know, thought out, but. But it's just something that sort of works. And we've all sat in the cinema and seen 1,000 films and felt what it's like to be in that kind of environment. And I'm sure that stuff just kind of seeps in.
Well, it's interesting that just the blue, which is not, like you said, exactly the color of water in a pool or in the ocean or wherever, is just referential enough, just kind of like the exaggerations are, they don't go too far, but they go far enough of form, you know, to still work, to still have magic or, you know, a recognition.
Yes, so it doesn't feel out of place. If you look back at the couple under umbrella, you know, that parasol comes
right.
down and it hits the floor exactly as if it's, as if it's disappearing into the floor.
Right.
You don't see a stand and a, you know, how is that held up?
Right.
It just goes in as if it was on the sand and
right.
going in. I mean, it doesn't actually. It's
but
just the way
the
it's
sand.
Made.
Yeah.
But, you know, you could have put sand in there and, you know, sculpted a half-eaten ice cream or something. And, you know, but those...
Yeah.
I think there's an end to the sculpture.
Yeah.
You know, there's a moment where the sculpture meets... the world it's in, because they're all in an odd place. They're all in a museum, which is a totally artificial
right.
environment. And, you know, there's other sculptures which are standing on plinths, you know. But you don't question, why is this guy standing on a white box?
Right.
it's just sort of
what you said.
Because
there's enough information.
Yeah.
But not too much.
Yeah.
Just enough.
Yeah, I think so.
But we're going to move on because we have 4 minutes.
Sorry.
So I want to also, you mentioned the cruciform.
Yeah.
And another new work that's in the exhibition, Still Life. There were three points I wanted to ask you about here. One is of the religious theme again.
Yeah.
The second is that it's called Still Life, and kind of the relationship to art history, not just sculpture, but all of art history, painting as well. And then the fact that it's a chicken and not a human.
Not a human.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's tall. I mean, I don't know.
It's 7 feet tall.
7 feet, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, let's take your questions in reverse order.
Okay.
Because I've forgotten the first two.
Fine. We don't have time for them anyway.
I think the sculpture sort of came out of seeing a lot of chickens hanging up like that. And Ron had gone to Mexico, and there were all these chickens hanging up. And I don't know, there must have been something about it, but something about the flesh or something that just sort of captured his imagination, and he started sculpting these things. But because it's blown up to this size, it's 7 feet tall, it's sort of human proportions. Mm-hmm. And that means that I think when you look at it, you relate to it. Mm-hmm. You know, that rib cage, it's not a rib cage, it's a chicken, but whatever it's got there, you know, is...
Breastplate,
something.
I don't know.
You know, it sort of feels like a rib cage because it's that sort of size, you know, which means I think you can relate to it in a bodily sense. You know, when you look at it, you feel body. You don't necessarily feel chicken. Although, I mean, it's beautifully sculpted, and the sort of chickenness of the flesh is beautifully observed and rendered, you know, in a way which I think must have been quite exciting for a sculptor who'd been, you know, sculpting people for so long, to have these new colours and textures and things to work. And you can see a sort of enjoyment, you know, in making these feathers and the texture of the comb on the chicken's head and the beak and, the claws and the feet are, you know, beautifully sculpted, and I think that shows a sort of excitement and an interest in observing these things. But the scale just makes it feel human. So I don't think you sort of question that in a way. You know, at first sight, or you know, in concept, it sounds like a complete departure. You know, my next sculpture is going to be a chicken. That just sounds crazy.
Right.
But actually, when you see it, it doesn't feel odd.
No.
It doesn't look out of place in that exhibition.
Not at all.
I don't think at all.
It's in the same room with Drift.
Yeah.
And
So that, you know, the fact that it is just, you know, it allows you to see, you know, there's a sort of cruciform image in the chicken.
Right.
Clearly, and you know, if you were thinking about religious iconography, you know, it might remind you of St. Peter being crucified upside down or something like that. It sort of reminds me a little bit of those upside down crucifixions of Francis Bacon and that sort of serpentine form coming down the cross. I think they're just little things that are there in the background. But what we've done by on this occasion having those two works together is, you know, we haven't overemphasized that. We've just allowed that to come to the surface a little bit.
Well, and I think, I mean, we are, it's 8 o'clock.
So sorry.
I think it's fine to stop here and have a few works in the exhibition that we didn't show or didn't talk about.
Yeah.
But when you see works like this and you think about the crucifixion or you know, there seems to be a reference to Renaissance paintings or history paintings, or, you know, in some of these works, there's an absorption of art history, I think. I mean,
I do, because, you know, although Ron's didn't have an art school training, so he didn't go to art history lectures like I did, but he did spend 2 years as associate artist at the National Gallery in London, where he had a studio in the National Gallery and the opportunity to roam the corridors of the museum.
Pretty nice.
Yeah, pretty good. And you know, he comes from a family background where the, you know, which is to do with art, and there's painters and other people in the, mm-hmm. the family. And I think as an artist, you just, you know, you sort of collect images and collecting images from art is part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think all of those, you know, those great artists from the past, they all just sort of change the way you see the world, don't they? And it's so it's difficult to see these sculptures without, you know,
thinking.
Without noticing those things, because, you know, what those painters and those artists did is they sort of invaded the way that we see everything, you know, and maybe now, you know, because of something, the way Ron's drawn our attention to things, maybe you see a little old lady sitting by the bus stop and you see her in a slightly different way.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, he's done what those other artists have done, which is just to, you know, which I think is what great artists do, is that they just, you know, change the way that you see the world.
I think that's a really good point to end on. Thank you so much, Charlie, and thank you all for being here.
We should have had another hour.
We did an hour.
We should have had another hour.